Well, it is a great pleasure to catch up with Justin Pugh for the first time. We were just saying it must be getting on for 30 years since we last saw each other.
Oh, probably about 1992, 1994, about around there, yeah, like at least, yeah.
And we went to the same school, and which is actually not far, of course, from where you live.
No, no, I mean, in fact, in the summer when I'm up in the bedroom and the windows are open, I can hear the kids in the playgrounds and that, like from the Bishop of Llandaff. So just a stone's throw away from our old school, yeah.
And does that take you back? So when you hear them, are you suddenly reminded of those days in the 1980s when you were there yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Playing cricket at lunchtime, you know, like I like to play cricket with some of my friends, you know, even in the winter. Just crazy about the game at that time, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it brings back memories, yeah.
And Cardiff, of course, is also, as it is for me, where you're from.
Indeed it is, yeah. I mean, you know, like, born here back in 1971, I've always lived here, but in various districts, you know, in the Heath in the 70s, and then we moved over here in 1980. My mother wanted her own house, and, you know, she'd lived in a parents' house previously, and also wanted me to go to Bishop of Llandaff. So we had to sort of be in the area then to go to that school. And then I moved down to Fairwater then in 2009, 2 years after my mother died. So
I have found that, actually. I think my parents were the same. They obviously want the best for you, send you to the best school. But
yeah,
it was only after I left the school and went to university that I realised, because I had a point of comparison, just how good a school it was.
Oh, and it
how,
was, yeah.
You know, in terms of the destination of a lot of the pupils.
Yeah. Well, my mother always used to say about the Bishop of Llandaff, if you were interested in your work and you wanted to get on and do well, the teachers would support you, and they certainly did with me, as they did with you, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was quite enriching, even after graduating, actually, from university, to be able to contact a couple of those teachers who I think at the time were still working at the school, and just to say, you know, thanks to you, back in 1980, blah, blah, you know, who'd have thought that this is where I might have ended up?
And, yes, quite.
And yes, I suppose a little bit of boasting involved in there, but also a nice way of actually saying, you know, the circle has been squared.
Well, yeah, all that investment invested in me, if you like, you know, has now produced dividends, so, yeah.
When you look back, because we were just talking a moment ago about seeing or hearing those school pupils from all those days before in Cardiff. I suppose two things there. First of all, you know, has Cardiff changed a lot? But also, what does that take you back to in terms of like childhood memories and growing up in Cardiff? And because for me, in a way, this is sort of returning to the source. You know, I mean, I've been back in Cardiff for 24 hours because it's just before Christmas 2022.
Yeah.
But in catching up with people, seeing the places, I'm very aware that, you know, if this was an origin story, shall we say, then, you know, Cardiff is where it all started for me, as university did when I was 18.
Yeah.
But in terms of your own sort of life story, your own trajectory, having stayed in Cardiff, how do you feel that it's changed?
It's certainly, I always thought, like, in the 70s and 80s, we were quite a sort of staid, you know, former Victorian, like, provincial town. Like, I mean, back then, you get Nationwide, like, in the 70s and early 80s on BBC in the evening, and, you know, Cardiff hardly got a mention, and I used to think, oh, why can't they come to Cardiff? And, you know, like, nobody talked about it, and it was very low profile. But then from the mid-90s, and particularly after devolution, then we were on the map. You know, Cardiff was cool. Like, students wanted to attend the university from all over the world. And, you know, we had the principal at the Millennium Stadium, as it was back then, open for the 99 Rugby World Cup. And, you know, Cardiff has become a true European city now. Like, you know, as I say, it's a cool place to be, you know, where the university is much in demand. So Cardiff is a lot more multicultural, and, you know, like, it's, I love being here. It's a part of me, you know, like, Cardiff flows through my veins, as it were. So, but, you know, the main change is that we, you know, our profile has been raised significantly, I think, you know, due to devolution. Yeah.
And I do remember that vote in, because I was in Lampeter at the time in 1997, and how the vote was won by a whisker. I think it was down to the Carmarthen, the last votes to be called were from the Carmarthen count.
Yeah.
And how it so nearly could have gone so differently.
Yeah.
And how ironic that this was only a few months after the big Labour landslide of 97, when all the parties who were elected, because the Conservatives ended up with no seats in that election in Wales, but all the other parties with the Lib Dems, Plaid and Labour, they were all pro-devolution. And yet the people were, decided to go along with the campaign by a whisker. And I always find that interesting because the story could so easily have been a very different one. Is that something that you feel very conscious of?
Oh yes, well the yes vote went by about 0.5%. Of course, in Scotland it was a thumping victory, but here, people were a bit agnostic about devolution at the time, particularly in the English speaking areas of Wales. My parents had a very British outlook. They, didn't agree with Welsh independence or separatism of any kind, or, weren't hugely keen on the Welsh language. But I made it my business to learn Welsh seriously. And, I speak it reasonably competently now as a second language. And I voted yes. And my mother had come round to voting yes, under my advice, and she seemed to be take an interest in the political views I had and came along with me. So and now we're certainly indie curious. There are a lot of people in Wales who vote for unionist parties such as Labour, at elections, but even so would be inclined to vote yes in an independence referendum. And in the subsequent referenda we've had since 97, that have proposed devolving more powers to the Welsh Assembly, there have been, significant majority yes votes. So I think faith and confidence in Wales in our ability to run our own affairs, is sort of growing all the time. So, we had a bit of a feeble start, but now, we're well on the road to, hopefully. I would call myself a Devo Max kind of person rather than a nationalist, but I think Mark Drakeford is doing tremendously well, as First Minister. So, I think, as I say, our confidence in our own abilities has grown admirably since from 97 onwards. So,
And I always remember you from our school days as being very politically conscious, very intelligent, very aware.
Oh, thank you.
And I always think the Lib Dems, of course. I think the Lib Dems were formed around that sort of era. And that's something that I always very much associate with you, that sort of period of the SDP, the Alliance, the Liberal Alliance, and then the founding of the Lib Dems. In fact, I'm reading Paddy Ashdown's diaries at the moment, and it's fascinating to sort of see how the journey could have been a very different one. And obviously back in 88 it was even squabbling over the name
and the
whole David Owens dimension as well. Two very sort of big beasts who are perhaps a lot in common, but were politically in many ways, or personally, sort of quite divided.
Yeah.
So is that something that you've always followed?
Yes, certainly. I was on the Liberal side of the Alliance. I was fascinated by the thoughts of the Liberal Party when I was about 16. I thought that the Liberals seemed to be subsumed by the SDP during the 80s, like they were forgotten about. And I thought, there's this old party, that has this great history, and I was curious to find out what they were about, and I looked into their, main sort of ideological planks, such as, a decentralisation of power from Westminster, individual freedom, electoral reform, social justice, internationalism, and support of the European Union. And I thought, those are things I can relate to. And I thought the Liberals, I liked the Liberals because they had more of a history. The SDP perhaps were a bit of what we used to call in the 80s a designer party, and then the merger came along and I went then with the Liberal Democrats, and on and off I've been with them ever since. So
I do always find it interesting that in the 80s, to someone like me growing up and being too young to vote, the SDP Liberal Alliance seemed a very sensible option, considering that we had quite a polarised, I suppose Neil Kinnock did change the Labour Party, but there was a point where, certainly in 83, the two main parties were moving in very different directions. And then in the most recent general election in 2019, and the couple before that, I was quite intrigued as to how the Conservatives were quite polarised, certainly over Brexit, and Labour as well. A lot of people couldn't stomach that. But the Lib Dems were offering a sort of, if you're against Brexit, we offer a very clear alternative to Labour. And yet they didn't do that brilliantly in the election.
No.
So, and I thought that was very reminiscent of the 1980s, when people are like, in many ways, there's something very unappealing about the main parties, and yet people do stick to the main parties when it comes to casting their vote. Or maybe that's due to our electoral system.
Yeah, I think that people have always said, well, a Liberal vote or a Liberal Democrat vote is a wasted vote under the current electoral system, so that's why nothing changes, really.
And do you think that has the capacity to change? Do you think that since Brexit, it's possible for there to be a realignment in politics? I suppose Brexit is now becoming quite normalised by all the main parties, in the sense that Labour are now saying we're not going to try and go back to the way things were,
no,
but actually accepting that it's more about making Brexit work than trying to return
turn
to
the back,
EU.
Realignment. Well, there are indications of that under the Corbyn leadership, like you had Labour MPs leaving and some Tory MPs defecting, and they formed Change UK, but that didn't really get anywhere. People said, well, this is going to be like the SDP and ergo the Alliance all over again, because they were gravitating towards the Lib Dems. But Change UK have now disappeared, and the people who joined it are now in the Lib Dems. So, I think now that Keir Starmer is leader of the Labour Party, there's much more uniformity across the UK political spectrum. I don't see any sort of restructuring of blocks at all on the political spectrum in Britain at the moment. No.
Who would you say are your political heroes? Do you have a particular hero?
Oh, yes, certainly Lloyd George for his People's Budget in 1909. The Liberal government before the First World War was every bit as radical as the Labour government after the Second. And another hero of David Steele, certainly, I thought he had tremendous charisma, like spitting image really used to reduce him to looking like a bit of a twit, really, in the pocket of David Owen. But he wasn't like that at all. He was a strong man with his own mind. I saw him speak in the hotel on Canton Bridge, which is now the Holiday Inn. This was back in 88, at the last Welsh Liberal conference before the merger. And he really inspired me to continue on that path of being involved in that political party. And another hero of mine was not even a Liberal at all. He was Labour Prime Minister, and that's Harold Wilson, I thought, there were so many overdue changes that, were made in the 60s, like the end of capital punishment and the decriminalisation of homosexuality, and the Open University was an initiative of the Wilson government. So, and Wilson was tremendously cool, I thought, with his Yorkshire accent and long raincoat and pipe. And, Labour, Blair, they say, is charismatic, but for me, Wilson was Labour's greatest leader. So, in fact, I've got a picture of him on the wall in the other room. It's hidden a bit by the Christmas tree, but
And I always find that in different generations, you see the same kind of issues coming up. It's very interesting. Well, obviously, independence and the whole devolution question that we've just been discussing was perhaps a bit before, well, both of our times really in the 70s. I certainly can't remember it first time. But I do find that it's that sort of sense of historical perspective is actually so important, and maybe some of our leaders sometimes should take more heed of precedent. I always find that prime ministers or leaders, someone like John Major, who at the time had a very rough ride as prime minister, now come across as very statesman and very wise. And I suppose it's because they're not having to deal with a fractured party, and they can say what they want to think, and perhaps in a way we wish the John Major of now had been the John Major in office.
Yeah.
But circumstances didn't permit that.
No, I like John Major a lot better now than I did then, you know. Like, I thought he was very much Thatcher's creature at the time, and, you know, and rather right-wing and uncaring, and, you know, like... But now he's sort of gone up in my estimate. And there was the thing with Edwina Curry as well, you know, that I didn't sort of think a great deal of that. But he's gone up in my estimation now, you know, where, like, he tried to stay Boris's hand. Like, he was certainly a pro-European. Like, his credentials in that department were immaculate. But... as you say, you know, people can grow on you, you know, maybe when they're out of office. So, yeah.
And I was just thinking as well, because this has brought me back to all of our sort of conversations in the playground, and because obviously we went to the same school. In those days, film, which is a big thing for me these days, was not even incipient. I would say that my whole sort of film interest sort of took place after university. Music was a big thing for me. But what about growing up for you? Were you very aware of you know, music or film, sort of various cultural influences? Obviously, you've always been a great reader. But how would you sort of sum up those sort of childhood years in terms of those wider interests that you had?
Oh, well, you know, in terms of artistic interests, I've always liked classical music. I was brought up with... my father was very keen on Mozart and Beethoven. For me, it was all about Tchaikovsky. I have his bust there behind you on the bookcase. And, you know, like, I had some initial misgivings, you know, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine about still, you know, listening to a Russian composer. But you can't hold, like, everybody of a particular... nation responsible for the actions of one man. Like, I mean, you know, like, most of the composers were German. You can't hold them responsible for Hitler, you know. So, but I loved my classical music. I also liked ska. I was very into the mod ska revival of 1979-81. I had a Harrington and Loafers and, like, Madness and Bad Manners and the Beat and the Specials and those sort of bands. And in terms of films, very, very keen on... I like the films from the sort of late 60s, early 70s period. I think that was the golden era of cinema, in a way. You know, you had the early James Bond films with Sean Connery, George Lazenby, and the David Lean films like Dr. Zhivago. I adored Julie Christie as Lara. You know, she was, you know, a teenage heartthrob of mine. And... what other, like Bridge on the River Kwai, you know, with Alec Guinness, some real classics were around at that time, The Ipcress File with Michael Caine. So, yeah, you know, I liked my films, but my tastes were somewhat retro, you know, when we were in school together back in the 80s. Like, I got into the Beatles, I discovered, like, in earnest around 85, and, you know, for Christmas 86, my mother bought me, my first sort of Beatles compilation, a cassette of all their you know, number ones from 1962 to 66. And she was saying, well, you know, why are you into the Beatles? You know, all the other children are into the groups that are around now, but, you know, you're like 20 years out of date. But that's the way I liked it. In the 80s, I was sort of into the 60s. Even though I'd not lived through the 60s, I thought everything I saw on the television and, you know, the music from that period, the 60s, was cool. And I thought, well, why couldn't I have been around as a teenager back then, you know? So I do live in the past somewhat, yeah.
Yeah. Although it's interesting, because as I was looking around to see the bust that you were referring to, I also see the Suggs autobiography on your shelf. So it sounds like that in that era, you were still very much involved in the, you know, the interest that you had, certainly in the early 80s. You mentioned The Beat, you mentioned Scar Madness.
Yeah.
Were very much of its time. And that's sometimes the best way to be, isn't it? Because I found that with my own parents who grew up, you know, it was the music of the late 50s, early 60s. Mm. I kind of inherited that. So I'd be at university in the 90s. And I was very much stuck in a sort of, I suppose, a Radio 2 kind of groove.
Yeah.
Where the music from that era, together with all the stuff that I grew up with in the 1980s, very much coalesced. And I kind of found that there was a bigger sort of hinterland. But the downside is, perhaps, that I didn't really follow through in a lot of that sort of era, the house music of the 90s and so on.
No.
So for me, I was very aware in the 80s of what was going on. I was aware of my dad and mum's generation of music. Mm-hmm. But then kind of film took over for me in the 90s and I lost interest in the music. So somewhere along the way,
yeah,
there was all this sort of like cross-referencing going
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
But then something took its place. And it's interesting now, 30 or more years on from that, to be able to sort of have a wider sense of perspective and to see how some of the... You mentioned the Beatles in the 80s, but
yeah,
but of course the Beatles are just as big now in so many ways as they were back then. So in a funny way...
They always will be, yeah.
Always will be. University.
Yeah.
Now, I remember you stayed in Cardiff. You'll have to remind me what you studied at university.
Economics. Well, philosophy, politics, economics to begin with, and then I was kind of thinking like... economics is a more serious subject, and you know, this is the one that's going to, you know, lead to a dazzling career. Like back then, it was the sort of end of the Thatcher era, beginning of the major one, and my cousin had got a degree in economics. You sort of think like when you look back, if only I'd known then what I know now, you know, I'd have done different things. Like I found economics incredibly hard going by the third year, and in a set, lost interest in it a bit, but persevered. I got a 2.2, you know, didn't quite get a 2.1 as I'd hoped, but you know, I think if I'd stuck with other things like politics and philosophy, I'd have smashed a 2.1, you know, then, you know, because those were more interesting subjects. So, you know, like one of the follies of youth, you know, as you get older, I find you've got to go with what's best for you and what you enjoy. And certainly when doing a degree, it's so important to do something you're interested in, like you did with theology. And that's what leads you, when you've got that passion there, that's what motivates you to hit the top grades, you know. But I'm very pleased I got a degree. Economics was a hard subject. Most people in my year got 2.2s in that. That was sort of about the standard average at the time, you know. But yeah, but I was an economics boy, yeah.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I found that with some of my own students.
Yeah.
Not necessarily students who've done religious studies, but the students I used to see in other capacities at university. And they would often take subjects because their parents had told them what to do or were encouraging them to go down a particular career path.
Yeah.
And it didn't always suit them. And I think you're right. If you don't do something about which you're passionate, what you're going to find along the way is that you just don't find that you're following through. You haven't got the same enthusiasm. And maybe that was the case with you. Maybe
economics wasn't
quite the right sort of subject for you at that point.
I think a bit of it was been all right, you know, like because it sort of goes in hand with to aid one's understanding of the political debate and to an extent a philosophical debate, you know, like I mean that you get economics is a backbone of Marxism and you know, like liberal free market thinking of people like Adam Smith and John Hume, who are also considered to be philosophers to a degree. And yeah, but I think, you know, some more diversity in my studies would be nice rather than concentrating on just one thing, you know.
But I suppose, and I think we've had conversations about this online over the last few years, but the opportunities may be to consider new pathways of study at different levels is always there as an option, and the way in which sometimes unexpectedly some of the things that you might be interested in now you couldn't have known that you might not even know that they were available as options back in the 1980s, for example. So do you feel that it's obvious that you've got a very big appetite for study and for being learned, but it's very obvious just from the conversation we're having.
You're very kind.
But do you find that is something that you would want to return to, for example?
Chris, definitely. You know, I mean, I nearly did a master's in psychology. I got accepted, and thank you for your reference at the time. But I found that I didn't have the capacity in the end with work. And what I am doing, though, is sort of an NVQ in counselling, and there's a lot of elements of psychology in that, and it's been going really well, you know, good feedback in the assignments I've done, so I hope to get that over the line now in January. So yeah, I think the interest in psychology and why people behave as they do and the factors behind that. And, you know, well-being certainly is something I've developed, particularly since COVID.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that there are certain things in the days when I was at university. I don't recall, you know, if students had a particular pastoral concern, there were people they could go to, but there was no system in place in a way that now, you know, there's a very clear system. If students have particular needs, if there's neurodiversity, if there's mental health issues, then, you know, then they need help and support, or dyslexia. There's a very clear mechanism in place. But I don't recall that being there. And so it's either that students in the 80s and 90s didn't have these on the scale that necessitated that sort of support. No. Or they were there, they were all buried, and most people just had to get on because there was no infrastructure, no means of support. But there's definitely been a shift in the last 20 years, I'd say. So subjects like you mentioned in counselling, or, you know, simply wouldn't have been options in the same way.
Oh, no.
30 years ago.
No, well there was some degree of stigma attached, I think, you know, it wasn't the done thing to talk about the way you're feeling, or, you know, whereas it's essential, it's really good for your mental health. There's no shame in crying, no shame at all. It's good to cry, you know, something about the chemicals in the tears, I believe. But, I think the way society is now is so much more refreshing compared to how it was. People can be open about their sexuality, all this infrastructure is in place to provide support for people who we all need to talk to somebody, from time to time to get things off our chest. And years ago, you just had to have a stiff upper lip, even in the 80s and 90s, and get on with it. You know, people brand you as, not you personally, but speaking objectively now, brand people as, well, losers or crybabies or, you know, nonsense like that. But, you know, I think society has changed for the better in that there's much more respect and empathy for neurodiversity, for autism, Asperger's, and much more understanding of that. And people know how to deal with it now, whereas they, it was swept under the carpet in the past, or, you know, people who were different, quote unquote, were treated with derision, you know.
And also I remember some of the things that would go on in schools, some of the bullying that went on. I find it interesting that, you know, all these years on, people don't forget. And why should one forget? I mean, if we all have, you know, there are always people that we think of very fondly and people we don't think of very fondly.
Quite.
and I think that is the real key thing, is that many years later, some people still need closure, and I would include myself in that, actually. And I always find it interesting. I wonder if those people are aware, maybe they're genuinely not, but aware that some of the things they did may have been injurious, and that all these decades later, that there's still a need, perhaps, for somebody just to say, "Oh gosh, you know, perhaps I regret doing that, and I'm sorry." I wonder what those individuals from yesteryear kind of feel now that the world, maybe hopefully they've moved on, maybe they haven't, maybe they've got children of their own, and maybe they're going through some of these same sort of crises themselves. But that for me is the interesting story, as to whether some of those issues are ever resolved, or whether, you know, we just have to somehow just find a way of processing and getting on, really, with some of those difficulties.
Well, for me, there's a very significant quote by a Holocaust survivor and psychologist called Viktor Frankl, and he said, "When suffering has a meaning, it ceases to be suffering." And for me, you know, I just like answers to what happened in the past. I don't hold grudges against the perpetrators, and I can forgive them, but it's so much easier to do that if you know why, people behaved as they did in the past. One guy who I'm not going to name actually came and apologised to me for, well, how he'd behaved to me in the past and years ago, and that meant a lot to me. And you know, where I forgave him instantly, and you know, like it's good to it's the not knowing is the worst thing. Like if you knew the reason why, that would contribute so much to the healing process. And people say, oh, you've got to move on, you've got to throw it over your shoulder, but it's not so easy. And negative things that happen in the past do bear fruit, like for victims in the present.
That's a really perceptive way of looking at it, because I always found that in the, you know, in school, sometimes, certainly when we were at school, there was a sense of knowing, and some people thrived in this environment. You know, this is the right answer. This is the way you do things. If you learn the right way to do something, then you'll do well.
Yeah.
Going to university also meant asking the question, why? Why do we accept this narrative? Why do we accept this paradigm? I still learn so many things from my own students.
It's a completely
different world. And I think it's the same in the sort of context that we're talking about.
Yeah.
That sometimes if you have the reason, an explanation,
yeah,
then you can sort of move on. Because otherwise, it's like in any other capacity, and you know, maybe I'm overthinking, but if I'm working on a project, if I'm writing a book or teaching my students, then you're trying to explore why things happen the way that they happen. And you're trying to go backwards, you're trying to go forwards, you're trying to sort of look at what this person says and that person says, and you're trying to sort of process it all. But sometimes there are these unresolved things from decades ago, and you just get stuck, and you're just thinking, you know, I wouldn't let go of anything in my academic life.
Yeah.
I would constantly ask and push and you know, leave no stone unturned.
Yeah.
So it's a bit difficult then in other contexts just to say, oh, I'm just going to have to leave that one because that's a stone that I'm not allowed to overturn. And I do think that there's been a shift, as you say, in the last few decades.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good when people can meet together with their former oppressors and, you know, talk and work things out between them, but you know, unfortunately, in the real world, that rarely happens, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so you're at university in Cardiff.
Yeah.
And what was student life like? Because I suppose you had it from a different perspective. Because I think you were living... Were you living at home?
I was.
As many of my other friends did, actually, who stayed in Cardiff and lived from home.
Well, I was a bit of a nerd back then, you know. If I was there now, as I am now, I'd probably go out and enjoy myself a lot more. But, yeah, I sort of heard about what student life was like through snippets of conversations between the others, before in tutorial rooms before the tutorial began, or waiting to go into lectures. There was a lot of hanging around pubs around Cotes and getting plastered, and you know, in the Union Bar, and you know, I think certain riotous parties went on in Cardiff Student Union, as I'm sure they probably still do. So I think the people in the business school where I ultimately ended up were very much of the mindset to work hard and play hard. So, you know, it was like the Thatcherite period, the fag end of that, beginning of the Major period. And, you know, like most people's objective was to get a decent degree and then go out and work in the city and make as much money as you can. So I think the culture in the business school was, you know, very much like a yuppie sort of culture. And, you know, I was sort of viewing it from the outside in. If I stayed with the people I knew, on the philosophy and politics courses I knew in my first year, they were a lot more socially conscious and, you know, more folksy in a sense. And, you know, that there was this softer sort of dynamic, you know, people were more accepting of each other and liked to talk about what was going on in the news and, you know, the rights or wrongs of various particular issues, as opposed to just, you know, this rather superficial sort of concentration on sport and partying and, you know, then, you know, sort of like work and doing as well as you could so you could make mega bucks. So, yeah.
Yeah, I do find it interesting that in that era, the alignment between what's going on politically,
yeah,
Thatcher's children kind of thing,
yeah,
and the way that we saw education, whether from the inside or, as you say, in some ways, if it is possible to stand out from that. But the student experience, I think, in that era, I mean, I suppose students in those days were living, in many cases, you know, the outside jobs weren't really that commonplace. I had a lot of friends who would work in the student union bar,
yeah,
but often they did it through choice rather than because they had to.
Yeah.
Because I don't really see any students these days who don't work. Certainly there may be some who only work out of term time, but there are plenty who are 19 or 20, and in some cases they're managing other, you know, not other students, but they're managing staff in the hospitality sector, for example.
Wow, that's amazing. A completely
different world to the one that I inhabited, that we inhabited.
Yeah, I think it was more, what's the word I'm looking for? Not innocent, perhaps, but you know, more of a privileged world being a student back then, you know, like lots of the people I studied with in the business school were from, you know, sort of around London and came from sort of an upper middle class professional background, and their parents had done very well and the expectation was for them to do well. There was that pressure, but, you know, they didn't need to work, you know, outside like their studies. They had enough support from their parents, and I was very lucky. I got a full grant. I was the last year of the student grants, you know, and my mother was a widow and, you know, she was in her 60s then, so and claiming pensions, so I got a very generous grant, and I was one of the only people still in the black at the end of the term, you know. So I managed to save money as a student. How surreal is that? Well, living at home and so on. But, as you say, that really is news to me that, you know, I know I've heard of, like, students today perhaps working in the bar or in a pub or, you know, waitressing or waitering in cafes and restaurants, but not managing staff, taking on all that responsibility and doing their studies as well. Their time management must be amazing in order to do that.
Yeah.
My time management has improved over the years. I used to be of the mindset where I used to work linearly, you know, like think, right, I'm going to do this thing first and I'm going to keep on going until I finish, no matter how long it takes. But now I will sort of like do an hour here on there on X and then move to Y and, you know, like rag everything on a spreadsheet, you know. I mean, it's useful skill I've learned from jobs I've been in. And, you know, so I think like back then students could lie back and take things for granted and life was easier perhaps. But now, you know, through necessity, students have had to become multi-skilled, you know, mature a lot more quickly than they did, and, you know, that can only be a good thing, you know, in preparation for, you know, perhaps if they end up, you know, having families of their own or, you know, in very sort of responsible jobs. It's that maturing process is an excellent pretext for going into the world of work. When I was at university, I went on, you had the milk rounds, well, you know this yourself, and I was absolutely green. I had no idea of how real life was, you know, outside school and university. It was a real culture shock, but, you know, I think kids now are so streetwise, and particularly, even, you know, when they're like 7, 8, 9 upwards, you know, where their IT skills are amazing, and children grow up a lot quicker and they're aware of the ways of the world, whether that be for good or bad. But I think it's a necessity for nowadays. Yeah, so the world is a lot less innocent than it was, say, back in the 70s, 80s, even early 90s,
And do you have any artefacts from that era? Because obviously these days it's very easy, as I do, to post on social media. I know you do the same.
Yeah.
But I can imagine that photographs and mementos are very important to you. Do you have diaries? Do you have artefacts from that era that you refer to, that you collect, that you have collected?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I'm really glad you've asked this. Like, I mean, for me, the golden period of my memories of my younger life were the 70s. And, you know, the period, you know, perhaps between about 75 and 1980 when I was cognizant. I don't remember before 75, but I like that, you know, I've got back into collecting the toys from that period where I can, like Britain's toys, you know, military stuff and farmyard stuff. And I'm man of 52 nearly, you know, but I mean, you like what you like, don't you? And Usborne books, they're brilliant, like the Usborne book on ghosts, you know, I bought before Christmas last year. It was in the school library and it was just nostalgia. I wanted to own it again. And like I go online looking for the old annuals like the Hotspur and the Warlord and Doctor Who and the limited edition Dalek annuals you had between 76 and 79. And, you know, I like anything to do with that era. You know, I look back with a lot of fondness on it. And, you know, in some ways, I wish I was a child again. But, you know, like I think that the toys and books and games, you know, that kids had back then was so much better than they've got today. Like, manufacturers were willing to invest more time in making things look really pretty and appealing. Like, the Ladybird books were excellent, like, in the 70s and early 80s, particularly their histories, like Alfred the Great, Julius Caesar, and the illustrations were so wonderful. But nowadays, it's all about unit cost and maximum profit, and, you know, they don't put the time and love and care into the products they produce anymore. So, yeah, I do have a lot of things from that era, you know, Star Wars annuals and the other annuals that I've mentioned, like Hotspur Warlord, you know, what's the other one? Victor, Book for Boys.
Yeah. I suppose as well, the journey involved in tracking down, finding some of those nostalgic items must have been part of the thrill, because obviously I'm guessing that you kept a lot from that era, but the fact that you've actually gone to the effort to find some of these, to locate some of these sources. So the quest, I mean, I'm a big believer, you mentioned Star Wars earlier, but the quest involved, I suppose, it accounts for maybe why I still go physically to the cinema rather than just sitting down and pressing a remote control at home.
Yeah.
That I like the effort involved in doing something, the physical involvement in doing something. So actually getting hold of these physical items, and presumably, I mean, I'm guessing you may have gone online to find them, or maybe you were going around various, the equivalent of secondhand bookshops. But I'm guessing that was part of the attraction.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, there's one in, I think it's the Castle Arcade or the High Street Arcade, and I was in town on a Saturday afternoon once, you know, for something completely different, and I stumbled across it by chance, and they got Airfix models in there, and that's another thing I collect, Airfix soldiers, and from back in the day, they're great, you know, and like Star Wars figures and the old annuals, so yeah, you know, like stumbling across somewhere like that is amazing, and going up to Hayes sometimes with a good friend of mine from up the road, like browsing the bookshops there and finding these gems. That's an enormously rewarding day, a lovely day out, you know, nice way of spending one's time.
And is this something that you can share as well? Because I'm always keen to share a lot of the things that I do, social media. You always find particular communities and groups of people who want to follow through on this. But is that something is it very, sort of very solitary, special to you? Obviously it isn't, because you have a friend that you do that with.
Yeah.
But do you find that has also put you in touch with a lot of people from the 70s, the 80s, who share that nostalgia? Has that created new or re-established old kinships, friendships?
No, not really, not in my case. It's more of a solitary thing. But, I mean, the friend that I go up to Hay with, like, he comes down quite often, you know, on a Saturday night for curry or Chinese or something, and, you know, watch a bit of Netflix, have a few beers, and his eye always alights on something. Ah, I see you bought a Star Trek annual, and I remember Star Trek, and, you know, that it sparks a good discussion. That's the good thing about it. Or, you know, for example, my favourite Doctor, you know, Doctor Who was Tom Baker. You know, he's never been, there was never anyone as good, well, maybe John Pertwee, but, you know, no one maybe as good before or since then. And like, I like to collect the DVDs of his old episodes that, you know, take me back to my youth and the thrill of watching those for the first time. And, you know, like, there's one, City of Death, you know, which involves an alien trying to, threatening to destroy Paris, you know, and, like, the DVD case was on the arm of the settee, and, you know, my friend that I mentioned, he was down for Chinese one night, and he saw that, and, oh, what's that, you know, so I told him all about it, and we ended up watching the four episodes of that particular Doctor Who story. So it's a sort of icebreaker, really, for having a pleasant evening and an interesting conversation when people come to your house and who are of a similar age, and they spot these things, and, you know, it sort of deepens existing friendships by having those things in common.
And did you find, when you were watching these episodes, that it took you back to the days of, I'm assuming that you watched them first time around.
Oh, I did.
In the days when you had to watch them at whatever time, 6:30 or whatever the evening, because of course we didn't, I suppose VHSs were around, but not, certainly not in the 70s, in the Tom Baker days. So did it fit, did it align with how you thought the episodes were? Did it take you back to that particular period of growing up? What was it like to re-experience those all those years on?
Well, watching, you know, City of Death and Destiny of the Daleks, for example, took me back to September, October 79, and, you know, like, at the end of the week, having done a week of school, and, you know, the weekend was the period to relax and enjoy yourself, and, you know, like, I mean, watching them again has given me a new understanding and greater appreciation of what the stories were about. Because when you're 8 or 9, you know, like, you know, your sort of like intellect isn't as fully developed as it is when you get older. Like, I'm not sure mine has developed at all since that time. But, yeah, you know, like, it gives you a new perspective on the stories. And, yeah, you also relive your youth, you know. Like, I remember the summer of 79 was a particularly happy one. Like, had a nice holiday in Cornwall with my parents. The sun was shining and, you know, both parents were alive then. And my auntie and uncle had just moved up to Anglesey and, you know, never been to North Wales before, so my dad drove us up there in the car, you know, and, like, that my auntie and uncle lived in a lovely bungalow in Benclech Bay, and we stayed in a guest house and just went back and forth between the guest house and this bungalow my auntie and uncle in, and it just brings back those happy days, you know, of that particular time, you know, that you get these nice fuzzy, warm feelings,
And that segs perfectly to my next question, although I think you've answered it, about whether your memories are predominantly positive ones as you look back on your life and career.
I try and, you know, sort of ring-fence the positive ones, and that's what I take forward with me, you know. We all have, we've all got to take the rough with the smooth, but, you know, the trick is to make the most of the best moments we had, and, you know, like, I think we can learn from the mistakes we've made and, you know, try not to make them again. I think the benefit is of getting older, like, when you're a child, or when I was a child, I could be very tactless and, you know, say things, and, you know, if perhaps maybe if I've hurt someone's feelings in the past, I'm sorry, but, you know, You tend to think more as you're older, well, hopefully, of other people and the impact of your behaviour upon them. The golden rule is to treat other people the way you'd like to be treated. And I think our whole lives are a journey. Well, Buddhists would call it enlightenment, Christians would call it salvation, but, you know, to being as good as you can be, you know.
And I think there is something really important about that notion of whether you can be, for example, nostalgic about negative experiences, and I agree. I think that there are times. I mean, a bit of bracketing out might be entailed.
Yeah.
But the sense in which sometimes we reflect on what may have happened, maybe we do, and maybe we don't always learn from the mistakes. Or in my case, I sometimes feel that I'm aware that I'm replicating some of the same structures. Or you find yourself in relationships or in situations, and you think, I've been here before, but I'm going down the same sort of path. But it's having that reflection, and that I think is part of it sometimes, as you said earlier about healing in the context of a bullying context. Yeah. Sometimes it just takes someone to say sorry, and suddenly you kind of feel that a whole, you know, that the cloud is lifted. But it's the perspective on the past, I suppose, that is key to this.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think everything happens for a purpose, and, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And you can learn from everything that's happened in the past, and the key thing is to learn from it, not to forget these experiences and keep making the same mistakes, or try not to do that. You know, I think everything good and bad is part of the journey that we're all on, and happens for a purpose. And at the time, it doesn't make sense, and it can be very painful, but when you look back on it, you think, well, I've learnt from that, and it's made me a stronger person, a better person, and, you know, hopefully with the new experience and perspective I have, you know, I can make someone else's life better, you know, or, you know, avoid, like, getting into awkward situations again, you know, myself, yeah.
What do you think your younger self imagined that you'd be doing now? Did your younger self have an idea, a particular sort of career aspiration? What would your 5 or 15-year-old self imagine that you'd be doing now?
Oh, gosh. Well, when I was 5, I was obsessed with cars, you know, a motor salesman when I was 5. That was my big interest then. I collected lots of toy cars and... but when I was 15, at that stage, I was set on going into science, you know. I liked chemistry very much in school at the time, and I thought, I'm going to be an industrial chemist and go to Salford University, and, you know, it didn't quite work out like that. I went more towards the social sciences in the end, but, or the other thing, coming to think of the age of 15... I really wanted to be a cricketer. I wanted to play for, you know, Glamorgan or Middlesex or England, certainly, you know, those were the sides I followed at the time. And, you know, I used to watch, my heroes at the time, like Phil Edmonds bowling or Paul Allett or who else was around, Graham Dilley, you know, or Boycott was sort of still just about around then. And, you know, players like Alan Lamb, Mike Gatting, and I thought, Paul Downton, great wicketkeeper back in the 80s, I want to be like them. You get you sort of hold people up as heroes, you know, when you're young, icons from sport or the cinema or, you know, from music. And, you know, but I think, you know, as we get older, we mature and we value ourselves for who we are rather than, you know, try and copy other people. But it's good to have these role models to aspire to, you know, for kids, like footballers now, Messi or Ronaldo, or, you know, sport keeps kids fit, and, you know, where they learn lessons about life, you know, from playing football or rugby. So you know, but I mean, as we get older, we stop idolising these people, and I think become more individual. Well, hopefully, individuality is one of the most important things in life, you know, and I think following the herd is not good, you know. You have to be true to yourself, or to thine own self be true, my auntie always tells me, quoting from Shakespeare. Hamlet, I believe, is that.
Are you still in touch with some of those people from the past? I suppose social media can...
Yeah.
Although, obviously, you're still living in Cardiff, I guess, you have those... Yeah. Always retain some of those physical connections. But are you still in touch with those friendship groups from the past?
With people from school, you know, Dean Burnett, Simon Patterson, you know, friends on Facebook. Rhys Llewellyn was in my class, and... You know, we're all, a lot of the people who are at the Bishop of Llandaff, you know, are very supportive, mutually supportive, and a lot of the girls too, you know, and Anna Sweeney, I see shopping sometimes with her children, you know, and Like, yeah, like, I was a bit down about something last summer, and, you know, like, guy called Simon Patterson reached out on Facebook. He said, oh, what's the matter, you know, I'll come round your house when I'm in your area tomorrow, we're old school buddy, and, you know, we'll catch up. So we sat outside and had a beer, you know, and a lot of the people were at Bishop Landiff with me, and that they all look out for each other. So I think that's nice, particularly as you get older. And in my case, I'm not married yet. Well, you know, neither of us are now, you know, but, you know, it's important to, you know, not to get too isolated. It's all too easily to get all too easy to get very isolated and not have support networks and, you know, friends who you can reach out to and talk to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And often it's very reassuring when some of those friendships from the past become new friendships, which offer all sorts of possibilities for the future as we all go through our own life experiences together. And sometimes it's beautiful, actually, when sometimes you just find that that the things that you had in common when you were young are also a sign that perhaps we have stable personalities, or that there's enough in common for us to kind of feel that it's worth investing in these friendships.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Like, friends, the most valuable thing that you can have, you know, more valuable than, I don't know, like, really sort of like state-of-the-art television or laptop or phone, or, you know, like, all these sort of like status symbols that people have nowadays. Nothing is as good as a friend. Like, I do miss my friend Amory, you know, like, who I told you about, you know, like, he died the summer of 2021, and, you know, I really connected with him on a very deep, you know, spiritual and emotional level, you know. And so, yeah, but friends, you know, are, as you say, most important. And, well, I think most important thing in your life, really. Yeah.
And my very last question, Justin, would you consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think I look back in the case of sort of like, you know, taking the best from the past, and, you know, like, it's nice to have these fond memories, like Christmases years ago. Like, my dad did the best Christmas lights ever, I thought, and I try and emulate that, but I don't think I'll ever be as good as he was. But, you know, so it's always good to hold these things in your heart. But, you know, like, you have to look forward. You can't live in the past, you know, and you've got to, like, I mean, we don't know where we're going, you know, with absolute certainty, but we have to have some sort of roadmap to, you know, at a high level to, you know, to act as a guiding light for our way forward in the future. So I would say I'm more of a looking forward person on balance than looking back. Yeah.
Well, what an absolute... We'll have to make sure we don't leave it another 30 years
before. Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
But Justin, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Lovely to, you know, catch up and do this interview today.